for me. We'll get to the budget stuff a little bit later this morning. We'll talk about it a little bit. We're not going to talk about it nearly as much as I promised you we would last week, or as I said we would in the e-news that went out on Monday. For some of you, you're disappointed. For everybody else, I guess you're maybe probably a little bit excited about that. We're not going to be talking about budget, but and we will talk about that a little bit later. But this week, as the week went on, it became clear to me that there was something else that needed to happen. As of Wednesday night, we had decided as elders we needed to move away from as much of the budget talk, and I began preparing a sermon for Thanksgiving. Got about half of a sermon for Thanksgiving ready to go, so I'm good for next year. But about halfway through, I just realized that there was more that God had for us this morning. As I saw the rhetoric being spouted by our politicians, as I saw the rhetoric being spouted back and forth by people that I respect, Christians on both sides, back and forth about refugees and what you do with all of this, it became clear to me that I think God had a message for us as a church. So I want to go back through Matthew chapter 10. That's what we're going to do this morning, kind of a review of what we've covered over the last 6 months. But I want to do it with the view of these refugees from Syria. I want to do it with an idea, kind of put a pair of gospel glasses on when we look at this issue and take a look that looks more at the kingdom of God before it looks at our own personal kingdoms. I want to say a few words of caution before I get into this, because I know some of you are pretty nervous about this. I am 100% certain that it would be impossible for me to make everyone happy with this message, especially if I went right for the political point of view. And I know it would be 100% impossible, because I know from my Facebook feed that some of you have one view on this subject and some of you have an entirely opposite view on this subject sitting in this room here this morning. So I know that as we get into this, but I want to re-emphasize what I've told you before. I will never, to the best of my ability, I will never let politics cloud my preaching of the gospel. Politics will never trump the gospel. And if politics are a stumbling block to the gospel, I pray that God will open my eyes to it and will remove that from what I do here. But where the Word of God and my preaching of the gospel touches a political issue, I will not shy from that either. And so we're going to talk this morning, but that being said, I'm probably going to disappoint some of you, and so I want to temper some expectations. Some of you are going to wish I would go further in what I say this morning. It is my goal as I go through this to specifically, what some of you are hoping that I'm going to address is whether or not the United States should take in these refugees. I'm not going to talk about that this morning. That's not going to be in my purview of what I'm trying to do. That's not the focus of this message. In fact, I don't know that I'm going to say much about it at all. I'll tell you, I personally have a very strong opinion about this and what it should be, but that's not what I'm up here to talk about, okay? The bottom line is that God has not called me to be a politician or to speak on political matters, so I'm not going to. But at least not in this environment. If you would like to go grab a cup of coffee, then we can argue over that just fine. But in this environment, I'm not going to do that. But he has called me to preach his word, and so I am going to do that. I will say I think this is a complex issue. I think any idea to reduce this to simple kind of name-calling back and forth is just silly and not helpful at all. Deciding what our country needs to do to protect its citizens while showing compassion at the same time, it can be complex. I don't think it's as complex as some people want it to be, but it can be a complex issue. That being said, our politicians have made absolute fools of themselves this week on both sides of the aisle. So don't hear me citing one or the other. Our president refuses to acknowledge the evil that exists that's causing these things to happen, and he refuses to say that America should lead. That, to me, compared to the America that I know and that I grew up with, is embarrassing. It's shameful. The Republican candidates race to a microphone with the compassion of a bulldozer to say the things that they've said this week is just as shameful in the ways that they have said it. So I want to be clear, neither side here, I think, is really doing all that well this week. It's unfortunate that our system is rigged so that people have to do things to get votes that frankly make them terrible leaders and terrible governors. But that's what they have to do to get votes. I hate it that it's rigged that way. But that's the way that it's set up, and that's the way the American people, us included, respond. Neither side, at least in my opinion, on this issue this week, seems to really understand the America that I was taught to love. And the America that made something special in this world. So with all that being said, I just want to make it clear. The side that I'm on this is irrelevant. And both sides seem to be falling way short, in my opinion. So with that said, I want to review some things from Matthew 10. And I want to see what the Bible says, what the church should do to respond to this. What the church should do, not what our nation should do. And I want to be clear, I am not saying the response our nation should have. But I do think God is clear that He gives us pretty clear instructions about the response the church should have. And then at the end, I think I'm going to give us a little bit more personal perspective and have some people share with us that can help us a little bit. So open up to Matthew 10. I want to give a couple of insights here, and we'll see where the morning goes. The first point that I want us to see in review of this, the first thing that we have to take into consideration as we look at Matthew 10 and we consider all that's involved in this refugee thing, the very first thing, fear cannot lead us. As God's people, fear cannot lead us. Let's just read this. Let's just read Matthew chapter 10, verse 26. So have no fear of them, for nothing is covered that will not be revealed or hidden that will not be known. What I tell you in the dark, say in the light, and what you hear in whisper, and what you hear whispered, proclaim on the housetops. And do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear Him who can destroy both soul and body in hell. Read verse 28 again. And do not fear those who can kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear Him who can destroy both soul and body in hell. The vast majority of conversation I have seen and heard over the past week has been rooted in fear. It has been rooted in fear. Our politicians can smell it like blood in the water. They go after it. They go after it because they know that if they can say something that makes you feel secure, or that something they will do will make you feel secure, then you are much more likely to give them your vote. Why is it that way? It's because fear is a powerful thing. It is a powerful tool in Satan's arsenal against the mission of the gospel. Fear will make us irrational. Fear will make us do things that are desperate. Fear makes us do things that we would otherwise never even consider. But when we have that sense of fear kind of sitting on us, we will do things and we will respond in ways that don't even make sense to us, the ones making the decision in a normal circumstance. As Christians, we have to be aware of the role that fear plays in our lives. We talked about this a few weeks ago when we looked at this verse. The idea that we want to fight fear with fear. The reality is that fear is a natural emotion, if that's what you want to call it. I guess it would be emotion. Fear is a natural emotion that will arise in us. It's what we do when we are confronted with that fear that tells so much about us. In and of itself, fear is a morally neutral thing, but unfortunately for most of us, it has been corrupted and it has been used against us in a way that frankly enslaves many and certainly drives your worldview for so many others. We will do anything to eliminate fear. We will go out of our ways to eliminate fear and save ourselves. Right? This is what every horror film is based on, right? We understand this. Why do people, whenever you're in a horror film, run up the stairs whenever the bad guy comes out? Why does that happen? Because you make stupid decisions, because you're just trying to save yourself, right? That's why this happens. And because it makes the plot a lot funner than if you just, you know, killed the guy. But this is what you do. You make irrational decisions. Christian, anytime you make a decision that is driven primarily by fear, you show that you distrust God and that you have believed a lie. And that lie is that you are in control. That you are in control. When you let fear guide your decision-making process and you let fear determine how you set things up in your life, then you believe you are making choices that put you in control. And if you're in control, you can thereby at least minimize your fear, if not altogether eliminate your fears. That is a lie from Satan. Control is always, 100% of the time, control is an illusion. And it's an illusion that causes most of us to make decisions that don't line up with the gospel. You are not in control. And making decisions that eliminate your fear, that are based on fear, show that you believe you're in control. And I've said this before, one phone call will shatter that illusion and show you just how out of control you are. God calls us to give up that illusion of control, give up that idea of control, to give up that dissatisfaction that comes when you feel that control ripped from you. Instead, He calls us to trust Him, to lean on Him, to know that He truly is in control of every situation. And you turn that fear of losing control into a healthy fear of God that drives us out on mission. So check yourself this morning. Are you making a decision based on fear? Not just in this refugee thing, in any idea, in anything, are you making a decision based on fear? If so, what is it that you fear? And if the answer is anything besides God, then you need to stop and repent. He has called us to live and to fear something far greater. Even as He says, Jesus says explicitly, even greater than death. As Christians, we cannot live in fear, and we cannot be driven by fear. God has called us to something much more. The second thing to consider from Matthew 10 as we look at this whole thing, the second thing is, this world is not our home, and we exist for another kingdom. This world is not our home, and we exist for another kingdom. Look at a couple of different verses here, verse 7 and 8 first. And proclaim as you go, saying, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out demons. You received without paying, give without pay. Then look down in verse 37, skip down just a little bit. Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. We cannot live this life as Christians constantly trying to hold on to something and protect something. We are called to let it all go. You cannot live a life built on the gospel while trying to hold something behind your back and hold on to it tightly enough that you'll never have to let go. You inevitably will choose one over the other. You cannot live that way. When you read these verses in chapter 10, it becomes very clear that we cannot expect to live lives in perfect security and comfort. We cannot build walls around ourselves and isolate ourselves from others. And I'm going to tell you this. This is whether it's because you're scared in fear or because you're lazy or because you're uncomfortable talking to others. And I'm not just talking about, you know, other people, other nationalities. I'm talking about your neighbor next door or your friend down the street or the cashier at Food City. Whatever it is, you cannot build walls around yourself to try to create security. To build walls around ourselves is a response completely opposed to the gospel mission we have been put on. I'm telling you that as someone who is an introvert and struggles with this massively. I would much prefer just to do my own thing and just to sit in my office and sit in my house and take care of what I want to take care of and read a book and I would be fine. But I know to live life that way, completely isolated from others, is contrary to the mission we've been put on. We are clearly called to engage people with the gospel. We are clearly called not just to engage people with the gospel, we are called to engage people with the gospel, specifically people that make us uncomfortable. Specifically, according to Matthew 10, people that may do us harm. To love people, according to the Sermon on the Mount, to love people that may hate us. This is what we are called to. You may not like that. That may frustrate you. That may annoy you. You may want to argue about that. But this is clearly what Jesus says. So if you want to argue about it, you can. But you're not arguing with me. You're arguing with Jesus. To live a life focused on building our kingdom and protecting our kingdom as opposed to sacrificing everything in the name of God's kingdom is to live a life that denies the reality of Christ. Denies the cross that He bore for us and the mission that He has put us on. To live a way focused on building our kingdom flaunts rebellion in the face of God's mission. We cannot live as though this world is our home. We cannot. Our series that we're doing right now is called Kingdom Come. It's based on the Lord's Prayer from the Sermon on the Mount. And He prays, He says, Your kingdom come. Thy kingdom come, Your will be done. When we pray, kingdom come, that is not a prayer for our kingdom to reign. It is a prayer that our kingdom will be destroyed and that His will topple all other kingdoms. His kingdom is supreme over all kingdoms. That includes kingdoms in Syria. That includes the sandcastle kingdoms that ISIS is building, and it includes the sandcastles that we are building in our own backyards. Our prayer is that God's kingdom will topple ours. His kingdom is supreme. And we are both citizens and ambassadors for that kingdom long before any other kingdom. As such, we should seek opportunities to further God's kingdom long before we seek to protect our own. Again, you can have whatever opinion you want about what politicians should do. I'm telling you what God has called us to. And He has called us to reach out to the ones that the world has rejected. Look at that again in verse 7. Proclaim that the kingdom of heaven is at hand to the sick, the dead, the lepers, and cast out demons. The people nobody wanted to have anything to do with. That's who God has called us to reach out to. And to welcome them into our lives, no matter the cost to ourselves. This is the church's response. I'm going to keep saying this because some of you are out there trying to argue with me about what America should do right now. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about what the church should do. We are to love others no matter what it costs. This is clear. The third thing to see this morning is that there is a great reward attached to a great opportunity. Start reading with me in verse 39. Whoever finds his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. Whoever receives you receives me, and whoever receives me receives him who sent me. The one who receives a prophet because he's a prophet will receive a prophet's reward, and the one who receives a righteous person because he is a righteous person will receive a righteous person's reward. And whoever gives one of these little ones even a cup of cold water because he is a disciple, truly I say to you, he will by no means lose his reward. I remember talking with some guys when I was in seminary, guys I had class with. They're all married. Most of them had kids. And I remember talking with them, and it was such a joy to be in seminary around these guys. There was a lot of people that were looking to go to school to be preachers. There were a lot of guys that were just there like me that had no idea what we were doing there. And then there were a lot of guys that were there because they were heading somewhere else, somewhere outside of the U.S., some South America, some were going to Asia and China, some were going to the Middle East. All of them took their families, and all of them were well aware of the cost. I remember one family had three sons, and they were preparing to move to Turkey. That's where they were going. At the time, there were some skirmishes that had broken out, and I remember some people talking to this family and saying, "Are you sure that this is what you want to do? You think maybe you should consider someplace else to go? I mean, after all, you're taking your family to this place. Is this exactly what you want to do?" More than one person told them that this was a dangerous mission field and maybe they should reconsider. Nonetheless, I would talk to him. I worked with him at UPS. We went to church together. He would pray daily for the people that he would be going to minister to. He was strategizing about how to meet people, about the best way to learn the language and how to learn it quicker and how to assimilate into that culture in the quickest way. The amount of work that he had ahead of him was staggering. I just needed to get through school and then figure out what God wanted me to do. He had to get through school, and then he had way more to go. They had so much to learn. I admired their faith as they worked through all the issues that were required for them to go on the mission field. I mean, honestly, the amount of work they had to go through just to have a conversation with somebody was just years of work. And here's what's amazing. There are people from another culture that are coming to this culture. I'm not just talking about refugees. I'm talking about all kinds of different things. We're going to hear about that in a little bit. But there are people coming from another culture here. And that massive amount of struggle is taken away from us and put on them. They have to figure out how to speak the language. They have to figure out how to do grocery shopping. They have to figure out how to assimilate into this culture. That they have to learn all of that stuff. That struggle is taken away. When the world comes to America, we have a massive opportunity to reach out to these people. We have a massive opportunity to reach out to the same people that missionaries spend years trying to figure out how just to have a conversation. And yet they come here. We would be foolish not to take advantage of that opportunity. No matter what our politicians do, no matter what the outcome is for this, I mean, reality is, even if they open things up, one, the number of people that they're talking about in comparison to the massive amount of people that are there, it's really just kind of a drop in the bucket. Plus, they're probably not coming to Jefferson City anyway, so what does it really matter what our response is? Our response must be that we have to seek out opportunities to build God's kingdom anytime we can. We must be kingdom-minded people first. When we live for God's kingdom and let go of our illusion for control, our desire for stuff and for security, when we let all of that go, there is much to be gained. We will get to know people different from us. We will get to share the love of God with the people that may have never known it otherwise. We get to have the satisfaction of being on mission with God. I could talk forever about what is gained by stepping out of our walls and out of our structures that we've built for ourselves and just reaching out with the gospel. The world is hard. The mission is difficult. But listen to Paul's words from 1 Corinthians chapter 9. "Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one receives the prize? Run so that you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable." God's kingdom will not pass away. Your kingdom, I don't care how much control you think you have over it or how much you labor to build it, it will pass away. Labor for God's kingdom. Pursue the prize that is Jesus Christ. and take advantage of the opportunities that God has given us. I mean, think about this. The evil that is spewing in the Middle East right now, the hell-bound plots of ISIS, are used by God to bring us in contact with people that would never have heard the gospel otherwise. That is amazing. And that is a God that is in control. ISIS and their plan can be used to... We can turn their plan to destroy people into a grace-expanding, hope-renewing, kingdom-building thing if we choose to, if we pursue the prize. Run so that you may obtain it. Pursue Jesus Christ. This is my last point for the morning. A little bit shorter sermon, but again, a little bit more coming on the end of this. So I just want to... The last thing, point four, the news will move on, but our mission will not. The news will move on, but our mission will not. Reporters are going to be coming home this weekend. I doubt you're going to see Lester Holt or whoever standing over in Paris this week. They're going to come home. Our memories of this will wane. We will, our consciousness as a nation will move on, and there will be some other topic about red cups or something that we'll be debating. It's going to move on. It'll happen. By Thursday, we're going to be watching parades and dog shows. Like, it's coming. You're going to sit down and eat more food at one sitting than some of these families have eaten in months. You're going to move on. The news cycle will move on. The politicians will find something else to talk about to get your vote. And that's okay. I don't want to shame you for that. That's part of what makes America great. We don't live in such fear, and our country isn't being taken over. So we can move on, and we can watch dog shows, and we can do those things. That's fine. It's okay to do that. But these kids, these women, these men, they will remain. This crisis is not going away anytime soon. And no matter what our politicians choose to do, they're not going to solve it by 10,000 or 20,000 or a million. They're not going to solve the crisis. The refugee numbers will grow. The news will move on. But the refugees cannot. But you know what else will not just move on? That's our mission. It will remain. It remains until Jesus returns and every tribe, tongue, and nation has heard the news of Jesus Christ, and we, the church, are the ones called to carry out that mission. No one else will do it. It is our task that we get to be a part of. This is not some guilt, you need to be a part of this. This is not some guilt trip of, oh, if you don't do this, God's word won't go forward. God will make his word go forward with or without you. It's just whether or not you want to be a part of that amazing journey. So I want to challenge you that you don't just move on from the mission Jesus has given us. Reread Matthew 10. You tell me what your response should be. You may have been heartbroken this week, and you may have been completely numb. You may have been scared to death. It doesn't matter. The mission remains. Don't forget that. Don't forget that. I want to ask Melissa and David if you guys will come up. We're going to spend a few minutes. I wanted to talk to Melissa and David, and for those of you guys that haven't met them, they are a pretty awesome couple that we've gotten to know. They're in our Front Porch community. I've tremendously enjoyed talking to them, and I just want to ask them a few questions kind of about what they do and really kind of how this would relate to some of what we've been talking to and how some of it won't. So, guys, if you want to just, you know, briefly introduce yourselves a little bit and then say a little bit about what you guys do at Carson Newman. So.
Okay. I'm Melissa Semmy. I'm the Assistant Director for Global Education at Carson Newman. My job is split primarily between two things. Mostly I help with our study abroad programs, promoting them and encouraging our mostly American, but sometimes our international students to consider spending time abroad. And I also help provide services to our international students who are on campus.
My name is David Crow, and I'm a teacher of English as a second language at Carson Newman. So I help a lot of international students just raise their English level enough to either take an undergraduate class at Carson Newman or just to get a better job. Anywhere in the world, if you know English better, you can usually get a better job.
What kind of students do you guys work with? Just roughly, like, kind of a profile of different ones and maybe kind of a number. What kind of students do you guys work with?
This fall, we have our largest international student enrollment. We have 122 international students from 32 different nations. We will get maybe upwards of 40 new students in January here in the next 6 weeks to 2 months. David teaches at the ELI, so he has 8 students currently. So the ELI has maybe a third of our overall international student population. And then we have a lot of students who come in and don't need to take any additional English classes, and they go straight into undergraduate or graduate courses. So we have quite a variety of students this semester.
Where are most of them from?
This is an interesting fall. Not only we have our highest enrollment, but it is the first time that we're aware of where Middle Eastern population is our largest on campus. Our largest country group this year is from Saudi Arabia. And then I think our second largest group is from China, but my numbers aren't quite fresh in my mind. We have a large number of Asian students. And then a lot of our diversity, because we have 32 different nations, we have a number of students who come to be athletes, student athletes, Carson Newman, swimmers, tennis players, basketball players, soccer players. Some of them are the only student from their nation on campus. So we do have a lot of students that are the only representative from their nation, or maybe they're just one or two of them on campus. But I think we have around 25 Saudi Arabian students that are enrolled. The other number that, or the other way that number can be slightly deceiving, is we do have a number of students that come to study and they bring their family, a spouse or children. So we have 122 students who are enrolled on a U.S. issued visa. But then if they've got a spouse or children that are not studying at Carson Newman, our international community at Carson Newman is well over 150.
You were telling me a little bit just a couple weeks ago, and when we talked earlier in the summer, about some of the challenges that they face when they come here, whether it's childcare or just making friends, conversation. Can you share with us just a little bit about some of those challenges that they have when they come?
Sure. As David can tell you very quickly, a number of them have language concerns. You know, they get here and they think they speak English very well because maybe they're the best English speaker in their hometown. And then they get here, and maybe they've been studying British English for 10 years, and we don't speak British English. And we don't even speak Boston English here. We say things like y'all and fixin', and they don't know what we're talking about. And who knows who their roommate is and where they're from. I mean, it's very challenging, the language issues. The majority of them do not have access to a personal vehicle. I don't know how many of you guys have tried to live without a car for 6 months. We try to encourage them not to walk to Walmart because it's not really safe, but they do it anyway. So transportation can be an issue. Obviously, you know, I was just thinking earlier, I'm going to have some childcare issues later this week when I have to work and I don't have daycare because they're closed for the holiday. But our students who come with children have a lot of concerns with daycare and filling out applications and which one's good and which one's bad and how much money's enough. I mean, you know, just I think we may have even had a Middle Eastern family who were refused daycare in Jefferson County last spring. And the only thing we can gauge is that maybe that daycare was turned off by the fact that the mother had a veil on. I don't know. So they drove back to Knoxville every day with their two preschool children, and then they had classes 30 hours a week. You know, those things are really challenging. They're challenging for our family, and we don't have the cultural concern. So transportation, daycare, holidays, you know, when the students go home, if they don't have the money or the connections to travel, 3 weeks in a ghost town of Carson Newman is awfully lonely, isolating, and all they've heard is how Christmas is the biggest holiday all year, and they want to experience it, and then there's nobody there. The cafeteria is closed. It's snowing. There's two individuals living in a dorm, you know, so holidays can be challenging. And then, you know, they've got questions about the immigration system and registering for classes and paying their tuition, and people on campus just say, go online and do it, and they don't know what that means. So a lot of challenges. And my office, that's part of what we do, is help them with those things.
So if you could communicate, we could talk forever. I love being able to talk with them. Let me just encourage you. Go to dinner with them. Their passion for this is contagious. They see these things firsthand, and I love being able to talk to them. I want us as a church to figure out some way to be able to partner with them, to be able to do things with them, and we don't know what that looks like yet, and so we're still working through some of that, but they have great ideas of how you could do things with them. And so I would like to know from you guys, like, if you could kind of communicate, you know, one or two things that you would want Providence to know about these students and their families, what would you want, just kind of share your heart about what you would like for them to know? So
I'll start with my first experience, or one of my first experiences with them. When I was told I was going to have a female Saudi student in my class, what was the first thing that came into my mind? The great news image of some terrorist lady holding up a gun or something, you know. Where did that come from? You know, have I actually met my students yet? No. But that's the first image in my mind. Fear. Now, later on, when I got to see my students, I realized from talking to people later, they were just as afraid of me because they had an impression of America that was not really the greatest. So we both came together kind of being afraid of each other. But we talked, we got to know each other, learned some English together, and it was amazing how ordinary they were, just like me. Like she said, just like our family, they had needs for childcare, they had worries for their kids. How can we do this in this new place, you know? But there's so much that was in common between them and me. So it was just great. Instead of, oh, that Middle Eastern country now, those people, I have a name and a face. I have real people that I know that are not necessarily like what the news portrays everybody in the Middle East as. And I don't fear for my life when I go to teach with them. I love these people. They're some of the kindest and friendliest people I've met. My students cook food for me, bring it to me, just because I'm their teacher. And I'm not talking an apple. I'm talking, you know, a good dish. So I'm just saying, these are real people. But you'll never know that until you get to know them. So please don't take just the news representation of internationals. And if you see someone with a veil on, stop and think, am I just being afraid of the unknown? Or can I just take a step out and say, hey, how are you? Smile. Doesn't cost you anything. I'll give you some examples of the teachers there. A good example of this is, some of our Saudi students have been so impressed by our professors. They ask about the families. Hey, how are you? How is your family? How have you been? Professors in their countries don't do that. But I've heard over and over again how just amazed they are. With the president of our college, he does the same thing. He really gets involved. What does that do inside? It changes them. It takes away their fear. And in the context of it all, where are they going? they're going to a Christian university. So how do you think that makes them feel towards Christ? It opens that door one step at a time, one little bit at a time. That crack of light comes in through the door. So I encourage you, have that kind of mindset when you're around internationals. You are the impression that they have, not just of America, that's not nearly as important. You are the impression they have of Jesus. And if God brings them right to your doorstep, what an opportunity. You don't have to go overseas. I guess my bottom line thing would be, what is going to bring them closer to God or farther from God? That's the bottom line. That's the rule of thumb I use. Is it going to be closing your businesses towards them, closing your homes to them? Is that going to bring them closer to God? Or is it going to be opening up your heart and your friendship to them? There are simple ways that you can be a part of things at Carson Newman if you want to, or people living in the community. There are conversation partners that we need. They want to have practice with a real person speaking. Can you speak English? I hope you can. That's all you need. Can you smile? Can you talk with people? That's it. This will really help them, not just in their English, but to feel like they're welcomed here. That's something easy you can do if you want to. If you see someone out there, you can eat with them, take them out to lunch, you know. Respect their differences. Remember, to be a Christian doesn't mean that you have to be American. I guess I'll close with the scripture that's been on my heart a lot in thinking about this. Think about in Romans 12, what does it say? If your enemies, they're not your enemies, but even if you consider them an enemy, what are we supposed to do as Christians? If they're hungry, give them something to eat. If they're thirsty, give them something to drink. And it ends with saying, don't let evil defeat you. Defeat evil with good. I hope you can do that.
Some of you, maybe high schoolers, middle schoolers, you may have stopped listening when we got up here because you think this doesn't involve you. But I do know that some of our international families have children that are at the Patriot Academy, at Jefferson Elementary School, at the middle school, the high school. Talk to them. A few weeks ago, I've been meeting with a young Korean girl just to help her with her English. She's really struggling. Her teacher talks really quickly. And she speaks English very limited, but we've been having a good time, and it was her sister's birthday. So I just made her sister a cookie cake for her birthday, because just to share a little bit of American culture, and it was like the biggest deal. Her sister's in high school, and she wrote me this long thank you note, longer than any thank you note my children have ever written, and she wrote it in English. And I could just tell it was so genuine, and she said, there are still many things I don't understand, and she may live here for years and not understand. But if you see a new student at your school, many of them may not look international. They may be European or Caucasian or, you know, from Latin America, and they may look Hispanic, but talk to them. If you do know that they're international, go to their baseball game. You know, write them a note. Meet them at their locker between classes and talk to them. You may be the only friend they have while they're here. You know, their parents drug them here. Maybe they didn't want to come, but even if you're in high school or middle school or elementary school, you can make a friend, and I guarantee you it will change your life for the better. Pastor Tony talked about our kingdoms. Is it our kingdom or God's kingdom? If you want to question what your kingdom looks like, make a friend with someone from another culture and start asking how much of your faith is your culture and how much of your faith is in here. Make a friend with someone whose culture is different. Don't abandon your faith, but be willing to let go of things that are your culture telling you. As David said, you don't have to be American to be Christian. We don't have it all figured out. And if you think I'm not really brave enough to share the gospel, that's fine. But our international students at Carson Newman, they're encountering the gospel. It's just whether it's genuine and whether it's real or whether it's they just see us waving high and then walking on by and never getting involved in their lives. You know, Jesus said, heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out demons. You kind of have to do all of those things by getting your hands dirty. Jesus didn't do that from a press box pointing out the demons, saying, go get that one. He was walking among them. He was touching them and being touched. We got to get our hands dirty. It can be awkward. It can be uncomfortable. I don't know what to say. I just said, hey, how are you? And they went, huh? It happens. Keep trying. David mentioned conversation partners. Nick and Brittany have already signed up for the spring semester to be conversation partners to one of our Middle Eastern families. Can you imagine what that's going to teach their children? And them? I'm just so excited for them. I know several others of you have been involved with international families over the year. Do you know what that's teaching your children? It's what we do that teaches our children, not what we say. Bring them into your home. If you don't travel for the holidays, if you stay around here, maybe you're retired or your family's far away and it's just the one or two of you eating Thanksgiving dinner, our international students love to experience an American holiday. If you're a Carson Newman student, invite one of them home with you. It will change. I guarantee you, I've had international students in my home when I was a student. They spent 4 years at Carson Newman, and they will say the best weekend of their life was when they visited an American home. Less than 5% of international students in America ever visit an American home. Show them what Christ looks like in your home. Yes, you may make mistakes. You may lose your temper with your children. That's okay. They do that too sometimes. But let them be a part of your life. Let them see you're normal and that you have real issues. The only way that we'll be able to minister to our international students when life happens to them, and life happens. We've had a student this fall who's been in the hospital more days than she's been in class. We had to have volunteer drivers this week take her to a doctor's appointment. I mean, she has some chronic health issues, and they're serious. The only way she's going to ask us for help when those moments come is if we've been there before. When our students lose spouses and parents and children, when they have babies and they want to celebrate, they don't call on strangers to be a part of those moments with them. They want people who've already reached out to them. And I think we have people here who can do that. So we have lots of ways, hands-on, practical ways. Obviously, we could talk forever, and we won't do that. But as Tony said, we'd love to give you practical ways you can help if you've just got 1 weekend to give or if you want to invest an hour a week or more. If you have particular countries, regions, languages that are of interest to you, if the Lord stirs something specific, if you're a Carson Newman student, you could request an international roommate. It's a great thing to do. Lots of ways to help.
Well, thank you guys. I would love to talk some more and to see just a little bit more of what you guys do, but I think maybe the best way to do that would be for you guys just to talk to them. As you can see, they're passionate about this, and I think it would be a mistake for us to let this walk by. The idea that people can come here and they can study and that 95% of them will never have dinner or go to an American home, that blows my mind. I think the church may have missed the boat on this one, and I hope us as Providence can maybe find a way to get in on this. And so I encourage you guys to chat with them afterwards, find out how you can go to lunch, find out how you can have dinner, and just see how you can be involved. So let me pray for us. Van, you guys can come on up. We're to go on a mission trip. Well, you know what? You don't have to. You can be on mission here for people that know nothing about Jesus. I could keep going. We're going to move on. Talk about vision and budget. Grab one of these on your way out. We're not going to spend too much time talking about this. I want you to look at it and see it. Things that I want you to know about this. 2016 is an important year for us. 2015 shaped up to be a bit of a transition year for us. And I don't say that negatively. I say that positively. As elders, we've been able to work through some very important things, to talk about some very important things. And so it's been good for us as elders, as a church. We've gone through transitions. Some families have transitioned into their communities where they're at, and we've had new families that have become part of Providence. And so it's all a bit of settling into who we are as a church and who we're going to be as a church. But this year will be important. There's some major, major things on the horizon for us. We're just really some government paperwork away from being autonomous as a church, separating completely from Knoxville. Autonomous does not mean financially independent. We're still dependent upon them. They are providing $40,000 of our budget this year. That's a significant chunk. So you should be aware of that. But this budget that's proposed, you can read all this, but I want you to know this. We're going to finish this year about $20,000 shy of our goal for giving. We knew that was probably going to be the case early in the year, and we manage expenses accordingly. So at this point, we're probably going to finish somewhere around $5,000, maybe $6,000 in the red. So short of spending more than giving. Could have been a lot worse than that, but that's where we're at. But I want to challenge you guys. We don't have to finish that way. We can finish strong in 2015, and what I would love is for us to finish this year in such a way that we don't have to touch our savings at all. But instead, in this last month, we can give in such a way that allows us to finish 2015 strong and really set us up for 2016. Consider and pray as you leave here today what God would have you give over the next month. We don't talk about money a lot here at Providence. In fact, we talk about it probably too little here at Providence. I'm saying that this is a big part of what we're doing. Money is a reality, especially in a church this size. So I want to encourage you, challenge you, to consider how you can give at the end of this year to help us meet our budget at the end of the year. Consider what that would be to help us get there. We're talking $5,000 or $6,000 that we're short. So that's where we want to be. The next thing you need to know is that our budget for next year is about 9 to 10% less of than what it was this year. So we trimmed in every place that we could. It's really a pretty bare bones budget. But we wanted to make sure that we got in line with what we thought we could achieve as a church. It still assumes about a 9 or 10% growth in giving. So I want to challenge you guys this year. You are critical to frankly, the survival and the ability for us to thrive as a church. Your giving, your inviting of other people to be a part of Providence and our growth is essential for us. That has to happen this year. That's not really an option for us. Knoxville cannot continue to give us the amount of money that they're giving us perpetually. We can't continue to function that way. We need to grow as a church. And we can talk about all kinds of reasons why that's true, but the bottom line is because we want to see disciples made and God glorified. We want to see that more than we even want to see Providence thriving. We want to see disciples made. I just happen to believe that God has called us here to this place at this time for that purpose. So be a part of that and help us to do that and to do it well. I encourage you, if you have questions about giving for this past year, about what next year looks like, all of those things, talk to one of the four elders, to me or to Spencer or Justin or Al. Talk to us and say, hey, what are you guys thinking? Why did you put this together this way? We'd love to sit down and have lunch with you and talk to you about this. Thank you, those of you that give. I want to encourage you, challenge you to look at 2016 and consider how you can maybe give just a little bit more. Maybe it's 1% more. Maybe you're just more consistent. Maybe instead of just kind of writing a check whenever you think about it, you sign up for online giving so that it's consistent and you don't have to worry about it. Consider how you can give just a little bit more to make Providence a place that where we can make a real difference and change Jefferson County. I cannot wait to tell you about some of the things that we have planned. The plan was to talk about it today, but God had other plans. So we'll be talking about it the first of the year, and I cannot wait. I think if you love Jefferson City, if you love Jefferson County, I think you're going to love what we've got planned for 2016, and I think you're going to want to be a part of it because you're going to see things change. So let me encourage you to pray and to think about what 2016 is going to look like for you and your involvement with Providence. We're going to sing one more song. This will be the perfect song, I think, to lead us into Thanksgiving week. That'll be our benediction. So you guys can stand and we will sing.